How much bikes are there?
I'd say there's 100% of bikes in out there.
There was just like dead radio silence for like 3 seconds. That's how my jokes usually go.
Prison was probably the best experience I've ever had in my life.
Hope you didn't get in a car wreck from that hilarious story that Frankie told.
It is like Comedy Central around here tonight.
It's got like one line. I'm in so much pain.
Welcome to the Can Be Now podcast.
We are the best and easiest way to stay connected to what's happening in your hometown. I'm Tyler Frankie.
And I'm Tyler Clausen.
The Senate Republicans have left the building. Again. Last week, the members of the minority party left the Capitol building, the Capitol City, and apparently even the entire state of Oregon to block the planned vote for House Bill 2020. The so-called cap-and-trade bill, which would establish a new comprehensive carbon emissions policy across the state and virtually all sectors of its economy, was approved by the Oregon House of Representatives earlier in the week and was headed for passage to the Senate. Representatives of both parties, along with Governor Kate Brown, engaged in more than 8 hours of negotiations over proposed amendments to HB 2020, well into Wednesday evening, the night before the planned vote. But a compromise failed to appear, and the next day so did the Republicans. As the superminority, Republicans are unable to block even a new tax, which requires 2/3 majority, with their votes alone. But by refusing to show up on the floor, they can deny the Senate the 20-member quorum needed to do business. It's the nuclear option, and it's one that they've employed successfully earlier in the season to stall the Student Success Act. The act ultimately passed, but it came with several concessions from the Democratic majority. The fact that it happened again was, in the words of Kate Brown, extremely unfortunate.
This bill would be historic in terms of Oregon would be the second state in the entire nation to move forward on a comprehensive cap and invest strategy. It would have been historic for Oregon, historic for the country, and frankly, historic for the world. Unfortunately, Senate Republicans failed to show up and failed to do their jobs. We have a bunch of young people here taking time out of their busy schedules to tackle global climate change. Future generations will judge us not on the fact of global climate change, but what we've done to tackle it. And literally, these young people's futures and their children's futures hang in the balance. It's critically important that we take action and that we take action now. It's time for the Senate Republicans to show up and do the job that Oregonians elected them to do.
For her part, Governor Brown responded by following through on a threat she had previously made to dispatch the Oregon State Police to locate and retrieve the unexcused members of the Senate. This extreme measure is not completely unheard of, and it has happened in the past. But it did raise questions whether state troopers were really being asked to round up absent lawmakers, cuff them, and stuff them into the backs of patrol cars. In a press release Thursday, the OSP clarified that they would seek to follow the governor's order in peaceful, gentle, and process-supporting ways. The OSP is utilizing established relationships to have polite communication with these senators, the release said. While we obviously have many tools at our disposals, patience and communication is and always will be our first and preferred option. Canby State Representative Christine Drazen responded to requests for comment Thursday, calling HB 2020 the most consequential bill of this season. California's cap and trade plan will harm hardworking families by making Oregon less affordable for everyone for an imperceptible change in carbon emissions, she said. Canby's state senator, Alan Olson, did not respond to her request for comment. On Friday, Clackamas County Republican Party Chair Tracy Hensley, who also serves on the Canby City Council, released a statement praising the Republican senators, calling them our last line of defense against the dangerous legislation being railroaded through this session. We are happy to see them stand strong, and we stand behind them, she said. If they don't, and the supermajority gets its way, they will render this state unaffordable for our families to live here. A registered sex offender whose last known address was in Aurora was indicted in Washington County last week on 19 counts of felony charges related to sexual abuse of underage males and luring minors online. The Washington County Sheriff's Office began its investigation into Adam Michael Wallace, 39, after receiving information from the Marion County Sheriff's Office about possible victims in their area. Wallace was arrested by Marion County earlier this year on 9 counts of sodomy, luring a minor, and sex abuse, and he remains in custody at the Marion County Correctional Facility. Wallace is also facing similar charges in Linn County and Colwitz County, Washington County, and has a lengthy criminal record, including multiple counts of stalking and identity theft. According to police, Wallace has been known to use social media apps such as Instagram, Snapchat, Grindr, and Hornet, as well as text messaging to get close to his victims. Wallace is also believed to have posed as a young person to make contact with juvenile males. Police say that he would then meet the boys in person and promise to buy them gifts such as clothing before sexually abusing them. Due to the number and widespread locations of the victims, as well as the amount of photos retrieved from the victim's phone, detectives believe that there may be many more underage males who have yet to come forward. The abuse is believed to have happened between 2015 and March 14th of this year, which is when Wallace was arrested by Marion County deputies. Anyone with information about Adam Wallace, who sometimes goes by his middle name Michael, is asked to contact the Washington County Sheriff's Office at 503-846-2700 or the Marion County Sheriff's Office at 503-566-6910. To see a photo of Adam Wallace, visit our website at canbenowpod.com. Police also remind parents to keep a close eye on their children's social media accounts and cell phones, as sexual predators use these as ways to contact their victims. The City of Canby on Wednesday unveiled a proposal for an alternate alignment of the proposed Industrial Park Access Road, one that would connect Walnut Road to Highway 99E at the site of Route 99 Roadhouse, formerly known as Double Ot Ranch. New access road for the Canby Pioneer Industrial Park has been discussed for many years as city leaders realize the strain that continued industrial development will place on existing transportation systems. Without a new access road, City Administrator Rick Robinson said the city's ability to support any additional industrial development would be severely hindered.
No, the short answer is no. We have pretty much exhausted the capacity at on Sequoia, which is our other access road to our industrial park. And so we are looking at ways to be able to continue to create jobs in our community within our industrial, within the lands that are zoned industrial that we have identified in this particular case as the Pioneer Industrial Park.
The city's 2010 transportation system plan outlined this project as an extension of Otto Road, one that would connect both Walnut and Molino. Although this plan is still favored by the Oregon Department of Transportation, Robinson said that the city has rejected the Otto Road proposal for a number of reasons, not the least of which were cost. In 2010, estimates placed the project at almost $10 million and the impact on the residents in the area.
As we looked at this over the last couple of years, staff felt it would be extremely disruptive to a number of property owners in that region if we followed that route. Those persons who have homes on Otto Road, those persons who have homes on the corner of Haynes, Molino, and First Avenue. Both would be very severely impacted if the Otto Road extension, as it has been, and I'll show you this in a minute, as it has been described, was actually constructed.
So an alternative alignment was designed, one that affects only 5 properties and would minimize the removal of existing homes. Robinson said the road would also be aligned in such a way so as to avoid impacting environmentally sensitive wetlands that exist in that area. Robinson said the city has met with the owners of all 5 properties and that they support the new alignment and are willing to sell right-of-way necessary to realize the new roadway. Several of those residents spoke at the meeting, including Ethan Manuel, who says the project does indeed have his and his neighbors' support.
We are very excited about this, honestly, as a group of Canby citizens. As you heard, the ability to build out the industrial park is contingent on having some sort of a plan going forward for another 99E connection. This has been under discussion where to put it for a long time. As you said, the auto road connection was identified at one point in the TSP. So it's important for our community and to keep that going. And the ability for us to all come together in this kind of a unique situation where it's going to be, as you said, much better than any other alternative that was out there, I think is exciting for the community.
Last week, the city began the first step in making the new access road a reality by agreeing to spend $595,000 in urban renewal funds to buy a property just north of the industrial park at the junction of Walnut and Southeast First Avenue. The deal is with local investment group Par Free Investments, though its current owner is Patty Green, a resident who has been critical of the city's handling of Project Shakespeare, the massive new beverage distribution and storage facility that will soon become the new Portland metro area hub for Columbia Distributing. The city's purchase is contingent upon Par Three completing their own purchase from Patty. She appeared at the city council meeting last week demanding to know why the city wasn't working with her directly.
Would you know that? Because I've asked you and called you and spoken to all of you about where I live and asked you to come purchase my property so you could put a road in. And none of you called me back. You told me you would call me. I'm for the project. I just wanted to sell my property and move my dad. Now you've messed him so much up from all of this. I'm just appalled at the city council for not coming to me. How many times have I been in front of you? How many times, sir? YouTube it. I'm there.
The city council did not respond other than to thank Patty for her comments. The resolution authorizing the purchase was approved unanimously. Two people were seriously injured in a head-on collision that occurred on Highway 99E between Gambie and Oregon City Wednesday afternoon. According to the preliminary investigation by Oregon State Police, 36-year-old Milwaukee resident, and I do apologize if I get this name wrong, Hosian Reslam, was traveling northbound on Highway 99E when his Toyota Tacoma crossed the center lane, hitting a southbound Jeep Commander operated by Lucia Smith, 28, of Hermiston. Both drivers suffered serious injuries. Reslam was transported by Lifelight to Legacy Emmanuel Medical Center, and Smith was transported to OHSU by ambulance. Highway 99E was closed for approximately 3.5 hours following the crash, which occurred shortly before 4 p.m. Oregon State Police reported receiving a driving complaint about Reslam immediately prior to the report of the crash. Captain Tim Fox, a spokesman for the Oregon State Police, confirmed Thursday that alcohol is believed to be a factor in this incident. Both drivers were still in their respective hospitals as of Friday afternoon, but both have been upgraded to fair condition. OSP was assisted by Oregon City Police Department, Gambie Police Department, Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, Gambie Fire District, and Oregon Department of Transportation. A Gambie businessman has been sentenced to 5 years in prison in order to pay restitution for defrauding at least four elderly investors out of approximately $284,000. James Robert Frakowitz, 44, was sentenced in Clackamas County Court after pleading guilty to 13 of 28 counts of aggravated theft and security frauds that he had been originally charged with in two separate criminal cases. Frakowitz is best known locally as the founder and operator of the now-defunct Frack Burger restaurant chain, which had a location in Gambie that's now home to Chipotle Express. The chain, which had as many as 7 stores in the Portland metro area at its peak, gained an early reputation for its high-quality burgers featuring Oregon-sourced grass-fed beef. But in the months and years before Frack eventually went out of business, that reputation would suffer, particularly in terms of its customer service. One Gambie resident even told us about a time that he visited and got his order wrong, but more wrong than most. He asked for a burger and they gave him a pizza. I mean, I don't understand how you get that wrong, but whatever. In addition to being a restauranter, Frackowitz was also an insurance agent operating under the business names Planet Financial and Frack Insurance. Starting in 2007, Frackowitz began selling a series of insurance policies that his elderly victims would buy and then surrender. The victims would lose money when they were surrendering these policies, while Frackowitz would gain a large commission. In 2013, Frackowitz created the Frack Income Fund LLC, which promised returns of up to 9% over a five-year span. The victims surrendered an insurance policy to invest in the fund and also made several additional loans to Frackowitz, who then funneled his money into personal debts related to his other businesses, including Planet Financial and Frack Burger, both of which closed in 2016. The sheriff's investigation into Frackowitz began in April 2017 when the granddaughter of an elderly couple approached detectives with concerns that Frackowitz was defrauding her grandparents through personal loans and life insurance policy purchases and sales. During the investigation, deputies also learned that Frackowitz had significant personal liens and personal judgment and tax liens. The Oregon Division of Financial Regulation discovered the scheme after receiving a complaint from one of the victims about Frackowitz's insurance practices. The investigation revealed Frackowitz was withholding and combining client insurance premium payments. The division revoked Frackowitz's insurance license in 2017 and fined him $14,000.
Located just off the corner of 13th and South Ivy is one of the most magical places on Earth, Puddin' River Chocolates. That's where Chief Chocolatier Teresa Sassy and her team of Oompa Loompa, employees, hand-make some of the richest, most delicious gourmet chocolates you can find anywhere. Yeah, that's right. Willy Wonka wishes he was this good. Teresa uses the highest quality free trade cocoa from around the globe and locally sourced hazelnuts, berries, and other ingredients to create world-class confections that are a treat to the eyes and the taste buds. And they do more than chocolate. The classic fondue is an ideal blend of Swiss cheese, wine, and spices that you have got to try. Puddin' River's creations make a great gift for a loved one, or hey, for yourself, because you know what? You deserve it. I deserve it, Frankie! Find them at PuddinRiverChocolates.com.
So I'm here with Derek Hill, president of Advantage Mortgage in Canby. I was wondering what's going on in the mortgage industry right now.
The mortgage industry is on fire right now. The big thing that's really exciting for us is that we are now an independent mortgage broker, which means that we can offer substantially lower rates and lower fees for our customers. For example, we just got a loan last week, and the realtor said, hey, I think you should go talk to Derek at Advantage Mortgage. And sure enough, we got the borrower 3/4 better rate, and we saved him $14,000 in fees.
Cool. So where can people find you?
So office number is 503-266-5800, or they can find us on the web at findtheadvantage.com. But most people just give us a holler or they stop in.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks, Derek.
You bet. Advantage Mortgage, NMLS number 1770599. Derek Hills, NMLS number 50183. Equal housing opportunity.
Should you vaccinate your children? It's an important and weighty question for any parent, made all the more so in Oregon this year as debate has raged over House Bill 3063, proposed legislation that would have no longer allowed parents to exempt their children from required vaccinations except for approved medical reasons. It's a loaded and very complicated subject, so we've asked for some help from Dr. Max Cohen, a naturopathic physician who has treated thousands of patients, both adults and children, in primary and urgent care settings in Portland. He takes an evidence-based, integrative approach to naturopathic and conventional medicine, and he's passionate about helping his patients achieve their health goals. He's also written a number of articles on the subject of vaccines, arguing that they are safe and effective. And he joins us now. Max, welcome to the Can Be Now podcast.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being on. So, as you know, Max, we reached out to some of our more, I guess I'll call them vaccine skeptical listeners from down in Canby, and asked them for questions, which you have agreed to answer some of them, and we really appreciate that. But I wanted to start by asking you actually a couple of questions that I have, if that's okay.
Yeah, please do.
So first, tell us a little bit about your approach to vaccines. So I know, like, you're a naturopathic doctor. When I found that out, I was really thrown for a loop that you would be, like, on the vaccine side, because I thought that those were kind of, like, opposed. So tell me how you kind of make your peace with that, or
how you approach vaccine medicine.
For sure. So I do hear this question frequently.
Yeah, I bet.
I think there's a lot of misinformation about what naturopathic doctors believe. I can only speak for my training program, but we're taught the CDC immunization schedule, the benefits of vaccination for both personal and public health. Mm. In fact, in Canada, the governing body for the naturopathic doctors there prohibits NDs from being publicly
anti-vaccine. Wait, so your offices aren't in like caves where you're like treating with just essential oils and not...
I like to shake the healing gourd too.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, the natural therapeutics are great, but at the end of the day, we know that vaccines are a safe and effective medicine, and so, you know, I think it's a complicated topic, and that's why we have to discuss it. So, are there anti-vaccine naturopathic doctors? Absolutely. Mm. Are they very vocal about that belief? Certainly. But in my experience, the pro-vaccine amongst my colleagues, we're often spending our time in clinic with patients and not super active on social media talking about why vaccines are beneficial. Mm. And that should change because we're losing a messaging war here. Mm. But in general, being pro-vaccine is a mainstream position, and it's not particularly controversial outside of the debate over vaccinations. A lot of clinicians simply carry on with vaccination without wading into the fray.
Yeah, and that's hard, right? Because like most people just, like in the public, just follow the social media, you know? So yeah. Like maybe they feel like it's more equal or more balanced because, you know, doctors are not wading into that because they're doing their doctor work, mm-hmm. you know? And that's just tough because you want doctors to be doing their doctor work. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and to kind of counter that, there's a vaccine education platform called NDs for Vaccines, where I and many other colleagues have posted articles dispelling vaccine misinformation. And the active membership in our pro-vaccine discussion and outreach group is around 180 clinicians. Mm. All of this is to say that NDs are hardly anti-vaccine as a rule, but just like in the MD community, there are vocal anti-vaxxers who draw a lot of focus. Mm. When it comes to vaccines and naturopathic medicine, I think of it this way.
Okay.
What is a supplement? For example, a licorice extract that we might use for heartburn.
Okay.
It's a purified form of a naturally occurring plant that has been processed, and we isolate the compounds we're interested in using, and we remove those we want to avoid.
And it's also tastes gross. Licorice tastes gross. I just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah.
It's not candy. I will walk out of this right now if you say licorice is candy. Like, do I need to turn off the recorder?
No.
Okay. please continue.
That's a natural product, correct?
Yeah.
Well, vaccines are a natural product in that way, too. We take a virus or a bacteria that can cause significant disease, morbidity, and mortality, and we purify it so we have only the parts of it that create an immune response. Mm. And then we expose the immune system to these naturally occurring proteins called antigens, and the immune system does what it's meant to do. It forms an immune response to these antigens so that if you ever are exposed to the real deal, your immune system has practiced fighting it off.
Mm. I've heard it described like vaccines create a natural immune response. Is that an accurate way to say it? Or
your immune system doesn't know where these antigens are coming
okay.
from. Whether it's an injection or it's the wild type infection.
Gotcha.
There's just a lot more of them if you get the wild type infection.
Yeah.
Right? But nothing in vaccines is synthetic or contrived in the lab. They're naturally occurring compounds interacting with your immune system's natural ability to fight off illness. It doesn't really get more natural than that in my mind.
Yeah.
And further, preventing infection reduces the need for other medical interventions. Say a baby gets an infection from Haemophilus influenza B. It's a particularly dangerous bacteria that used to be a real big deal before we had a vaccine for it. Mm-hmm. The baby may need IV antibiotics, which have a lot of additives in them.
Mm-hmm.
Steroids, a breathing tube, stay in the hospital, which gets you exposed to all the things that are in a hospital.
Yeah.
All those things are much less natural than letting your immune system simply protect you by giving it some practice with the vaccine.
Okay. Well, that makes sense, and it's cool knowing that there's, you know, I didn't just stumble across the only ND that's pro-vaccines. There's a group of you, and it's not as rare as I realized, as I would have thought.
No, not at all.
Okay, well, you know, I recently saw a video by Dr. Paul Thomas, who I know you're aware of. It was recommended to me by a non-vaxxer in our community, and Dr. Paul, for listeners who may not know, he's a pediatrician of a large and successful clinic in Beaverton, and he believes that vaccines can cause autism, and he advocates for an alternate lighter schedule that he calls a vaccine-friendly plan. It's a lighter schedule from the one recommended by the CDC. And anyway, in this video, he described hearing hundreds of stories from his own patients, from parents, of healthy infants who developed autism from
vaccines, you know, that he claims from vaccines, even within days, like, you know, in this video tells a story of an infant receiving a vaccine, then a few days later, he describes it as like they lost their child, you know, and it's very, as a parent, like those stories are scary to me, you
absolutely.
Know, so how do you respond to that?
Well, I would say they absolutely are scary stories, and that's the intention behind telling them. Mm-hmm. Fear is a really good motivator, and if your goal is to modify how someone thinks, fear can be a powerful tool. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in making decisions out of fear. Stories are a great way to sell an idea because they're relatable and feel very real. Data is much harder to conceptualize, and it doesn't feel personal.
Yeah.
Stories like this are designed to do one thing, and that is plant a seed of doubt, which they're very good at doing.
Mm-hmm.
But as my research mentors have always told me in the past, the plural of anecdote is not data. And to understand vaccines and their benefits and the risks, we have to look at the data and not the stories.
Yeah.
I think it's important to take a step back and consider a couple of phenomena here. One, we use vaccines on a population level. And two, there will be a certain amount of baseline neurodiversity in that population, such as autism spectrum disorders. And that's going to be no matter what. Because vaccines are often administered during the first 2 years of life, and the symptoms of an autism spectrum disorder will become apparent during the first 2 years of life. It's a mathematical certainty that a child who's going to have autism regardless of their exposure to vaccines will begin to show symptoms of this condition near the time of a vaccination.
See, I didn't even realize that. I don't know that much about autism or the study of it, but like there is often that, I guess you would call it a change, where it seems like a baby, you know, is healthy or doesn't have, you know, signs or symptoms, and those just start to develop out of nowhere. That's how it works.
Right.
Okay.
And that doesn't mean that the vaccine caused autism. In fact, we know that a lot of the brain changes that are that portend a future of an autistic spectrum disorder, they happen very early in life or even in the womb.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
So these are things that are happening long before a vaccine is ever administered.
Yeah.
And, of course, as the now famous saying goes, correlation does not equal causation. This means that just because something happens around the same time as something else, those two things aren't necessarily related.
Mm-hmm.
For some somewhat silly examples of this, your listeners can Google spurious correlations, and there's a large selection of graphs here that show really tight correlations between two totally unrelated statistics.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the number of people who have died by becoming entangled in their bed sheets closely tracks the per capita revenue of ski resorts.
Right.
That does not make them related.
Right, right.
And if you look at this graph, the trend lines are right on top of each other.
Yeah, and you have these illustrations that we can include in the show notes.
Yeah, yeah. I'll have the link for the show notes for sure.
Yeah.
So to know if there's any relationship between vaccines and autism, we should look to the now extremely robust data showing that there really isn't that connection.
Mm-hmm.
This question has been studied exhaustively, and there isn't even a hint of this claim being true. Nothing. Take the most recent high-quality study on it.
Mm-hmm.
Danish researchers looked at all of the children in Denmark born between 1990 and 2010. That's 657,461 children. This is a huge sample size.
So that's quite a few kids.
It's a lot. That's a lot of kids.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to count that many kids.
So they followed these kids for 13 years,
mm-hmm.
and they found absolutely no relationship between vaccination status, MMR, vaccine administration, and autism spectrum disorders, even in high-risk kids. And that was defined as kids who had an older sibling who had autism spectrum disorder.
Okay.
And that's because we know that there's a genetic component to these things.
Yeah.
So even in high-risk kids, there was no correlation whatsoever. In another study from Japan, an entire region in Japan quit using the MMR vaccine.
Right.
And the diagnosis of autism continued to tick up as the vaccine use went down.
Right.
So we see this totally divergent phenomenon where the vaccine use is going away, but the incidence of autism spectrum is still climbing.
Right.
So I think that's pretty strong. That is a pretty strong argument. Those things aren't tightly related.
Right. Right. Which you wouldn't expect if that was a causational factor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there are lots of studies like these. You know, those are just the two that I pick off the top of my head, but there's a bunch of them.
Yeah. Do you know who did the Danish study, or a way that listeners could look it up if they want to learn more about it?
I can put the link to it in your show notes.
That'd be great. So my final question for me, I talk to, you know, from posting stories about this over the past few months, I have encountered and met and been able to talk to a lot of non-vax parents, which I've appreciated and learned a lot from those discussions. But what I hear is that, you know, they're not necessarily saying vaccines are all bad. They're not saying that they never work or that they're a terrible blight on society. But really, especially related to this bill, HB 3063, they're really, you know, their anger about it is feeling like their options are being taken away, that their choices of parents and their concerns are just not being heard and not being listened to by the medical community, by the state government, you know, by whomever, and that just doesn't feel right, and that doesn't sit right with them, that, you know, that maybe they want to go a lighter schedule. Like, maybe they're okay with vaccines, or maybe they just don't like one of them. Like, maybe hepatitis B, for example. I've heard that. Mm-hmm. You know, that they feel like that shouldn't be necessary for babies who aren't sexually active, who, you know, don't have intravenous drug use or some of those high-risk behaviors. So maybe they just don't like one, or they just want to wait a little longer, you know, do that lighter schedule. And HB 3063 wouldn't have accommodated that. You know, it has to stick to the early CDC schedule. So what's your response to that? Who parents who just have certain concerns, not like no vaccine, I'll never vaccinate my kids, but just this feels a little better. I'm more comfortable with this.
So I think vaccine mandates are an incredibly tough topic. And I'm not a political specialist, nor am I a political operative.
Yeah.
But
that's exactly what a political operative would say, though.
Oh, dang it. You got me out. Well, yeah, you look for me to co-sponsor some bills. But I understand the strong feelings on all sides here.
Sure.
On one hand, we live in a society and we have a responsibility to one another to participate in public health initiatives.
Okay.
There are absolutely medical reasons that some people cannot be vaccinated, such as being immunocompromised or being too young to have certain vaccines yet. Hmm. Just a couple days ago, a baby that was too young to be vaccinated against measles was hospitalized in Washington State. Hmm. We have a responsibility to protect these
For measles.
Yeah, for measles. Yeah. One in four cases of measles is hospitalized. Hmm. And, you know, no one is advocating that we hold people down and forcibly vaccinate them. But if you intend to access public infrastructure, it isn't at all unreasonable to expect that you take part in public health initiatives. Hmm. Let's think about a non-vaccine example, because I think the vaccine example is so fraught. But if we think about this, does it infringe on your rights as a parent that we have child car seat laws? Hmm.
You're asking me.
I mean, would you say that, you know, is it an infringement on your freedom?
No, so, I mean, that's a good example, I think. Yeah, because it's like, I guess you could say that it does, but like, why would you choose that? Why would you choose to not, you know, put your kid in a car seat?
We as a society have decided that the overwhelming benefit of this car safety seats at preventing injury during crashes means that we're going to mandate their use and that there are consequences if you choose not to do that. On the other hand, having some vaccines is infinitely better than having none.
Yeah.
And I understand the argument that creating a mandate that is universal will run the risk of further marginalizing vaccine-hesitant parents, which will create pockets of susceptible individuals. And I think the answer here is that there aren't any easy answers, unfortunately.
Well, that's too bad.
I wish.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's get to some questions from listeners.
Sure.
What everyone's been waiting for. you know, and you mentioned this earlier, but I just had to get my last question in there. But the vaccine studies, you know, you're talking about that for a while. And one thing that I hear a lot, I got a lot of questions about this, so I'm not going to shout anyone out specifically just because it was one that came up again and again. It's just that there seems to be, and it just as a layperson in my own research, I've kind of found this to be true, at least from my ability to Google, that there seems to be a lack of studies that are just very simply comparing kids that have never been vaccinated versus kids that have had all the vaccines, you know, and just looking at the health outcomes of those two groups. I mean, and that was kind of the question. Is that true that that's a little bit lacking? I mean, like some of the studies sort of seem to look at, well, here's some who didn't receive one of the vaccines or not, you know, not all the vaccines versus none of the vaccines. Is that true that hasn't been really been studied? There hasn't been like double blind kind of studies, things that most pharmaceuticals get. And if that's true, why? Why is there not that there when people in the non-vax community are calling for that? They're sort of saying, like, we believe if you look at this, you'll see that ours, you know, outcomes are better. So
That's a great question, and yeah. I think there's a few issues to tackle with it. So, I mean, I'll just kind of wade in. First is that we do have vaccinated versus unvaccinated studies.
Okay.
You know, there are places in the world where the vaccine ratios are kind of flipped from where they are in the United States.
So it's much more unvaccinated versus vaccinated. Okay.
And in those areas, they have done studies on vaccinated versus unvaccinated. And not surprisingly, we see that the vaccinated population does much better because they're not ravaged by diseases that we can prevent. They are generally doing better across all metrics, and that's probably due to having a better access to healthcare.
Yeah.
But we do see that, you know, the vaccines prevent the illnesses that cause so many problems in these communities. Because we know that vaccines are effective, a study where we take a really large group and leave them susceptible to a disease is totally unethical. So, again, a non-vaccine example, we were studying a medication and we had a double-blind placebo-controlled trial, and we saw in the treatment arm of that trial that the treatment was so effective, the trial would be stopped, it would be unblinded, and they would immediately begin treating the placebo control arm, because that's the ethical thing to do.
Yeah.
Vaccine studies aren't different. No study would ever be approved if the protocol included leaving this huge population susceptible to infectious disease, right, especially since we already have such strong evidence that immunizations work and, right, and are safe.
Right.
In regard to that perfect vaccine study that I hear from everyone, we want this big study done on vaccine versus unvaccine. So let's just talk about this from a logistical viewpoint. It's not ethical to do that. We've discussed
with
that.
With the double blind, where and I mean, even just from the non-vax side, like if you're submitting your kid to a double blind study, that means your kid might get a vaccine. I mean,
exactly.
why would they want to do that? So,
but let's think about how we'd have to design the study to really get the answer. So let's assume that any study we came up with would be approved, so we don't have to worry about the ethical considerations here. Because the current data we have shows that adverse events are really uncommon, to get quality data on other outcomes, we would really need a huge population to be sure that we're capturing everything.
Yeah.
Right? If we just do, you know, 100 kids, we're probably not going to get a very good representative sample.
Okay.
So let's say we need a lot of kids, say 500,000 in each group. One's going to get all the vaccines on the schedule, the other gets none ever. So to adequately control for other variables like food, environmental exposures, differences in home life, parenting styles, etc., we somehow have to isolate these groups of kids for the duration of the study.
Right, to make sure that it's not other factors that are being responsible for. Because, I mean, and that is one thing that I think is true. Like, kids, families that are families that are non-vax are very health aware. You know, they're good parents. Like, they're,
of course.
So they're doing lots of other stuff as well that may be responsible for some of these great health. You know, they're making sure their kids eat good food, get lots of activity and stuff. So you have to control for that to make sure that it's not just those things that are creating the better outcomes, right?
And so how would we isolate them? Are we going to do two islands? Are we going to corral them on a compound somewhere?
Yeah.
If we want to do the study right, we're going to have to figure that out.
Yeah.
Let's say we did that. We've had them contained on their nice islands. And
they're all eating the same
food.
They're all exercising on the same schedule.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How long are we going to do the study? A year? 10 years? Right. 70 years?
Yeah.
If we're concerned about vaccines creating a negative health outcome later in life somehow, we have to watch them for a long time. So let's say we're going to do this for 50 years. But we also have to consider the other elephant in the room, susceptibility to vaccine-preventable diseases. Do we test that by exposing the two groups to different vaccine-preventable illnesses and see who has better outcomes? I know this all sounds kind of glib, but it quickly becomes obvious why we can't do a study this way.
Yeah.
And instead, we have to rely on the already high-quality data that we have.
Yeah, and I know you were just doing a scenario, but, like, you know, my heart skipped a beat when you said that. Like, I can't even imagine. You know, it sounds like something out of a dystopian sci-fi novel, you know. Like, it just, when no I one change, would ever support that.
When I change careers and then go into young adult fiction, that'll be my first one.
Right.
Vaccine Island.
Right.
But, in fact, many vaccine studies are done with placebo controls. The HPV vaccine, it was studied with a saline-only placebo control.
Okay.
I hear all the time that no study has ever been done on insert topic here, which is exactly what an anti-vaccine Facebook meme wants you to think. But in reality, these are really highly studied medicines, and they have a huge amount of safety data behind their use. That, of course, doesn't mean they're risk-free, but the risks are pretty minuscule compared to the benefits.
Okay.
We're going to go ahead and take a quick break to hear from our sponsors, and when we return, Frankie will be asking Dr. Cohen more of your questions, including, in the absence of the perfect study he described, how can we know that vaccines are safe?
Hey Tyler, did you know that the world has changed in the past 20 years?
No way!
Yep, it's true. The way people shop for goods and services has completely changed since this thing called the internet started catching on.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
And yet some realtors still offer the same old services in the same old ways and for the same old percentages. Victory Point Property Group in Canby believes it's time the real estate business caught up with the times. They'll meet with you for free, explain every step of the process, give you a clear game plan, and even let you choose the listing commission.
Really? They let you choose their commission?
Really? Victory Point Property Group understands this is one of the biggest and most exciting decisions of your life, and they'll do everything they can to make sure you handle it like a rock star.
Wow, that sounds great. I'm going to check them out by calling 503-263-4700 or by visiting online at victorypointhomes.com.
You do that. Victory Point Property Group, real estate reimagined. Don't you hate it when you're just getting caught up on your favorite show and then your video streaming service drops it without warning? Wouldn't it be cool if you could record unlimited programs at once and watch them whenever and wherever you want? Meet Easy Video from DirectLink, the only app-based TV service in Canby that includes most of the major live local broadcast channels, sports, and national networks. Easy Video is, well, easy. It's compatible with your Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, smartphone, and laptop, so you have more options for how and where you watch TV. And the best part of all, Easy Video members save an average of $360 a year over traditional cable. Say goodbye to HD fees, DVR fees, equipment rentals, and costly installation. Go to directlink.coop/EZV or visit them at the corner of Southeast 2nd and Juniper Street in Canby to learn more about the future of TV.
That leads us into our next question. Again, we got a lot of questions on. It's just, you know, okay, so we can't do the perfect study. So how do we know that vaccines are safe? A lot of parents were asking that.
So they are one of, if not the most studied medical intervention around. When we introduce a new vaccine, it's tested in animals and then tested in very small groups of people and then tested in larger groups and tested in larger groups. It is tested against all the other vaccines in the schedule to make sure that it is effective and it doesn't change the efficacy of the other vaccines, and it doesn't cause, you know, new different adverse reactions. We also have two separate monitoring systems that are constantly looking for negative vaccine reactions. One is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS, and the other is the Vaccine Safety Data Link, which is a more controlled research environment. The VAERS system you can report anything to, and there are all sorts of interesting reports because it's an unfiltered collection. They're just pulling in all the data they can and looking for little signals to come out. But, you know, people...
I saw some people that have... done like tests just to show that anything can go through, where they said like my patient turned into the Hulk or, you know, things like that. Just kind of funny things, you
right?
Know? Yeah,
yeah, and they don't filter that stuff out because the point is that they're collecting as much data as possible, and if they do start getting little hints of something going on, they immediately run that up to the Vaccine Safety Data Link, where they start doing really rapid iterations of short trials to figure out what's going on. And if a reaction is found and validated, the vaccine's pulled. It's just done. So an example of this would be the old oral rotavirus vaccine. It was found to very, very rarely cause intussusception, which, aside from being fun to say, is actually a serious illness. It's a telescoping of the intestines. It can lead to some bad outcomes.
I don't know what that means, but it sounds bad.
That's the best way to describe it. You can look it up if you want to see some awful pictures.
Nope, yeah, no, thank you.
But it was causing this at around the same rate of the actual infection that we were preventing.
Yeah.
So that's no good. That data was readily published. When that was discovered, the vaccine was immediately suspended. A similar decision was made regarding the old whole cell pertussis vaccine, or the DPT vaccine, for people in my age cohort, and I am dating myself there. That's the one that I got when I was a kid. It was an effective vaccine, and that's because it included basically an entire pertussis bacteria.
Pertussis is whooping cough.
Yeah. And they basically chopped it up and used all of it. So you were getting a huge amount of antigen in that, and it caused a lot of pretty intense reactions. Usually it was inflammation at the injection site, but because it caused these more intense local reactions, the decision was made to use an acellular pertussis, where they filtered out just the, I believe it's 6 most important antigens for preventing that illness. It causes a lot fewer kind of aggressive local reactions, but it came at the expense of vaccine efficacy. So the new vaccine will cause fewer side effects, but it doesn't offer the same level of protection as the old DPT vaccine.
Okay.
The decision to make this change was safety-based.
Hmm.
The researchers who are doing this work, they're caring, dedicated professionals, and we have a proven track record of them pulling vaccines when they're safety concerned. You know, I would say other times vaccines are just taken out of the schedule because we know we don't need them anymore.
Mm.
So a recent example of this is we found that if you have gotten at least one dose of your HPV vaccine before you're 14 years old, you only need one more and you don't need a third dose.
Okay.
And that had been previously recommended. That's one less dose because the vaccine is more effective than we originally thought. So this wasn't hidden. This wasn't swept under the rug. It's just we don't give that one if you had enough doses when you were younger. That's
yeah.
it. It's done. It's not a controversial thing within the scientific community to just move these things off the schedule when they're not needed.
Yeah.
Another example would be after 9/11, there was a big push to, you know, do we need to have the smallpox vaccine coming back out?
Yeah.
Do we need to vaccinate the entire population against smallpox? And the CDC initially decided not to do that because they did not want to go through that process, because that's another live virus vaccine. It's the one that caused a little scar you see on maybe parents or grandparents' arms, a little circular scar. And so, you know, they prevented 300 million people from getting a vaccine that, I mean, now in retrospect, we really didn't need. There was no smallpox at that time. But, they're honest people, and they are doing these things with public health and safety in mind.
Yeah. Okay.
I would say in general, we see that the risk of a serious reaction like anaphylaxis to a vaccine is just around 1 in a million in that ballpark. To put that in context, the chance of getting struck by lightning is around 1 in 700,000. And the chance of getting dealt a royal flush in your first hand of a game of poker is about 1 in 650,000.
Yeah, what about getting a royal flush while being struck by lightning?
We need a statistician on this.
Yeah, can we run the numbers on that? We'll do that on our next podcast.
Okay.
lower than a serious reaction from a vaccine.
And let's contrast that with the known rate of death from the measles virus, which is 1 to 2 in 1,000. This is many orders of magnitude more dangerous to catch measles than it is to receive a vaccine that prevents you from getting it.
Hmm. Okay. Erica Quill Engel, a listener, she asks, what do you see as the best strategy for talking with hesitant families as a care provider? And follow up, if trust is to be built incrementally, are there 3 vaccines that you would see as most important to have?
Mm. Actually, I would need a few hours to go over this one, honestly. I don't think there's a single best way to address vaccine hesitancy, but the tools are pretty similar each time.
Okay.
I need to be open to the conversation first and foremost. If the response is, nope, I'm not talking about that, vaccinate your kids or get out of my office, that is not an effective way to change anyone's mind.
Yeah.
And we need to be respectful of these views and then share reliable information about vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much misinformation out there that it's really impossible to address it all in 1, 2, or 10 office visits, but you can tackle a little at a time.
Okay.
If after these conversations someone is comfortable with vaccination and feels empowered in their decision, then I would call that a success.
Mm-hmm.
As for which vaccines are most important, I think that's kind of a contextual question and would depend a lot on the person and their history. Have they ever received vaccines before? Or are we talking about someone who's never had a single vaccine in their whole life? For the time being, with measles making its comeback, I think MMR would have to be high on that list, as would the tetanus shot. But I think it's hard to say broadly which 3, an arbitrary 3.
Right.
They're all important, which is why they're on the schedule.
Right. Okay, cool. Another listener, Anne Rob Puglius, I hope I'm not mispronouncing that, Anne, she had a question that kind of speaks to your personal experience, which I thought was interesting. So have you ever treated someone personally who's had an adverse reaction? And I think she means like a serious adverse reaction to a vaccine, like seizures, for example.
So I can say in my career, I've seen one adverse event, a febrile seizure after a vaccine. And
what is a febrile seizure?
So they're not uncommon. I'll say that first and foremost. They affect up to about 5% of kids. So that's 1 in 20 kids are susceptible to febrile seizures. And it's a seizure that is kicked off by a fever. It's not epilepsy in the vast majority of cases. And since fever can be a uncommon side effect of some of the vaccinations, it's not surprising that a child who's susceptible to having febrile seizures has a fever from a vaccine and then has a febrile seizure. You know, most kids grow out of them eventually. It's, you know, we don't have, most adults don't get fevers and then go into convulsions. 1 out of 20 of us generally don't. And this was reported to VAERS. I reported it immediately, and more importantly, the kid was totally fine.
No lasting issues.
And that's
good to hear.
They're not, again, it's not generally related to epilepsy. It's uncommon for there to be lasting issues after a febrile seizure. And for someone who's susceptible to them, it doesn't matter what the fever is coming from.
Yeah.
It can be that, you know, if they got measles, the fever spikes up to 104, they definitely would have had a seizure if they were susceptible to it in that case.
Yeah.
So, that's the only one I've ever seen. We certainly see, you know, redness at the site of injection, discomfort. It's, you know, they can be painful at the site that the vaccine is placed.
Right. But I mean, there's lots of kind of general symptoms that I've heard from doctors when we vaccinated our kids, like as far as, like, you know, they might be cranky. My kids are always cranky, so I don't notice any difference, but, you know, stuff like that. Like, they might be overly tired, you know, things like that. But do you have even, like, a ballpark figure of how many patients that you've, how many of your patients that you've seen vaccinated? Or so you've had one, you know, that's had an adverse reaction. I mean, out of hundreds, thousands?
Many, many hundreds.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would be accurate to tell you that it was in the thousands, although it certainly could be close.
Okay.
I mean, I would have to do an audit on every patient I've ever seen. Is it a negative vaccine and all of that? But they're a routine medical practice when you work in urgent and primary care.
Yeah.
And so, there's just a daily thing.
Cool. Shannon Casey, she asks, what is the evidence that vaccines do work? We've kind of been talking about that. And also, is it possible that, like a lighter or slower schedule, is it possible that giving vaccines spread farther apart rather than all at once? Because often, sometimes there'd be multiple shots in a visit or they're in the same shot. Is it possible that that might be a better way to vaccinate infants and children?
So these are important questions, and I'll start with kind of the evidence that they work. The evidence that vaccines work is actually pretty simple. When we introduce them, the rate of the illness we're preventing just drops like a stone. Measles was eliminated from the United States in the year 2000. That means that in the entire country for an entire year, not one case was found. And so it was declared eliminated because the vaccine's so effective. Vaccine rates have dropped since then, and unsurprisingly, we're seeing measles return. Listeners can Google visual vaccines to find an article with some very beautiful graphs that show how there's this immediate drop of different diseases when vaccines are introduced, and then how they come back when the vaccination rate starts to go down. I'll put a link in the show notes for you there. The immunological answer to that question is that we can show reliably that vaccines create antibodies against disease. So antibodies recognize the bacteria or virus. They focus your immune system's attention on it. So if you're exposed to it, you can fight off the infection without suffering.
So you can actually see the antibodies being created, and that's what vaccines are designed to do. So you can see that as evidence of it working.
Absolutely.
Okay.
With regard to the delayed vaccine schedule, a delayed vaccine schedule is certainly better than none, but here are my concerns with that. When we delay vaccines, we delay protection. During the first 6 months of life, you have a lot of circulating maternal antibodies. These are antibodies you got from your mom. They do a reasonable but hardly perfect job of protecting you from whatever your mother was already immune to. Now, these antibodies have a limited shelf life, and by 6 months old, you need to be making your own. So by giving some of the vaccines earlier, we reduce or eliminate the gap in that antibody production. So a baby stays protected. So if we delay vaccines, the gap between when you run out of mom's antibodies and when you start producing your own is wider and wider and wider. My other concern with the delayed schedule is just logistical. Spreading out the vaccine visits means more trips to the doctor's office and more instances of stress for the child. Say we're giving 3 vaccines at a visit. In my experience, if we're giving more than one at a time, after the first one has been administered, we can do the others without causing more stress.
Okay, yeah.
Generally, baby's already fussing because the shots can be uncomfortable, if only for a moment. But let's say we spread that out. That's 3 visits, 3 times they have to come in and get stuck.
Yeah.
They have more stress. It's more time off of work for mom and dad or whoever is parenting. And then there's just the risk of things like traffic accidents going to and from the clinic.
Yeah.
You know, these are things that happen.
Sure.
And all of that while we're delaying the protection from the vaccine.
Yeah.
So I think some of that confusion comes from a misunderstanding of how vaccines work. When we administer a vaccine, it goes into a muscle or into the subcutaneous tissue, and the local immune system in that area is really the only thing interacting with it at first. It takes up to 2 weeks for the local immune system cells to go back and spread the protection throughout the body through the lymph system.
It's not instant.
No, it does take some time.
Yeah.
So when we give 3 vaccines in a visit, they're staying at the site of injection for just a little bit, and they don't really interact with each other, at least not initially. The current vaccine schedule has been studied, and there's never been any good evidence that giving vaccines together is harmful. And it makes sense when you understand that they're just kind of hanging out at the site that they've been placed.
Yeah.
So to answer the question simply, no, spreading out vaccines is not generally going to be safer or better, but if that's how a patient wants to do it, I would so much rather have them have delayed protection than none at all.
Okay. So that would be something where you would definitely talk to the parent, hear their concerns, you know, kind of explain your perspective, but if they're still like, I still feel like this is better, that's you know, better than nothing. Like, you would you would go along with that for sure. Yeah. So, all right. Well, I think that's the last question we have time for. Stephanie Jean, she asks, if measles vaccines confer measles immunity, obviously measles has been the big subject of discussion this past few months, then why do already vaccinated children have anything to fear from a measles outbreak? And I wanted to end with that one because I think it's just a good question about vaccines in general, not even just measles. So, like, if I trust vaccines and I vaccinate my own kids, why do I even care, you know, if somebody else chooses not to? Like, my kids are protected, right?
Well, yes and no. And I hear this concern a lot. Yeah. The answer has a couple of components. First, it's that no medical intervention is 100% effective, and vaccines are included in there. I know. It's a terrible shock. So sometimes someone who got the vaccine will not form a complete immunity. So a vaccinated person may have a much lower chance of contracting an illness, but it's still possible to get a vaccine.
I've seen numbers for most of the ones that are in use around, like, not maybe 95%, you know.
It does depend on the vaccine.
Depends on the vaccine.
In the case of the MMR, it's 95 to 98%.
Yeah.
And then secondly, there are people who just aren't able to be vaccinated. This can be due to age, recalling we don't give the MMR until age one, or being immunocompromised. So if you're being treated for cancer, for example, your antibodies have been wiped out. So a choice not to vaccinate doesn't just affect you personally. It potentially exposes others to disease. I mentioned earlier about the baby who was too young to be vaccinated and was exposed to measles and then hospitalized. We can prevent that. Rubella is another example. If a pregnant woman gets rubella, it's devastating for the baby. By keeping herd immunity high through immunization, rubella doesn't circulate in the population, and then we protect everyone from it, even unborn babies. You clearly can't give a baby that's unborn a vaccine to prevent rubella, but we can prevent it from being in the community in general. When you choose not to vaccinate, you're taking advantage of the fact that other people are. You're, in effect, getting a free ride. When you choose not to vaccinate, you're taking advantage of the fact that other people are. You're, in effect, getting a free ride. But if more people start making the decision to reject vaccines, the exposure risk increases for everyone. And we're seeing this happen in real time in the United States right now. We have nearly 1,000 cases of measles confirmed, and probably more that are unconfirmed. Most of these are in unvaccinated individuals. We can prevent this from happening, but it relies on everyone working together to protect not just themselves and their families, but the community at large.
Well, unfortunately, that's about all the time we have. I thank all the listeners for your questions. I'm very sorry if we weren't able to get to them. We may do a follow-up at some point, or maybe with you, Max, or maybe somebody else, but just to get to some more questions, because I know there's a lot of questions out there. I really appreciate the questions. I appreciate the engagement. I appreciate folks listening right now that may be vaccine skeptical or hesitant. And you know, I just hope that we can continue to have these discussions and really listen to each other, because I found a lot of value from listening and gaining understanding from folks that may be hesitant or are just straight up, you know, non-vaxxers. I've learned a lot from them. So I appreciate folks opening themselves up to this discussion and listening. Is there anything that you'd like to add, Max, before we move on to something else?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I think it's a good conversation to have, and I appreciate the opportunity to do the work of educating around
vaccines. Thank you for opening yourself up, by the way, for to questions and just to sharing your own perspective and you know, sharing what you believe and what your experience has been, because I know that this, it's tough to kind of wade, like you mentioned, a lot of doctors don't do this, you know, so I appreciate you for taking that step. So,
well, and your audience asks great questions.
Yeah,
I think the most important thing that I want to end on is
we have the best listeners of any podcast.
Well,
that's clearly been, that's proven
obvious,
the science is in on that one, so.
But I think that the point that I want to end on is this, that we're all trying to do what's best for ourselves and our families. Mm-hmm. There are lots of things to worry about in our modern environment, whether that's global warming, agricultural runoff in the water supply, or just making sure that cleaning supply cabinet has a child lock on it. There's a lot to consider when keeping your family healthy. I want people to feel empowered about their health decisions and to know that when their, you know, clinician recommends vaccination, it's coming from a place of caring about keeping you, your kids, and the community healthy. When you have accurate information about vaccination, you can make an informed choice that isn't coming from a place of fear, and that empowerment is the goal of a conversation like this. So, yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Stay tuned.
Are you a small business owner or maybe thinking of investing in yourself with your very own startup? Awesome! Now all you have to do is reach potential customers at a time when consumers have never been more fragmented, more distracted, or more difficult to reach. If that sounds hard, believe me, it is. That's why I make Frankie do it.
Carrie and her team at Promotional Strategies offer strategic, purposeful solutions to build your brand with lasting promotional items that make sense for you and your company. They are creative geniuses who will deliver advertisements that people actually thank you for and will use every day. We've tried other sellers, and we trust Carrie to provide high-quality branded items that we can be proud of. Find them at 695 Southeast 1st Avenue in Canby or online at ps266swag.com. Beer is practically an art form in the Pacific Northwest. And the FOB Taproom in Canby is one of the best places to enjoy all your old favorites and your new favorites. They have a constantly rotating selection of 36 of the best craft beer, ciders, and wines from right here in Oregon and around the world. Hey Tyler, do you know what FOB stands for? That's right, it's Friends of Beer, and that's what they are.
Oh, well, the FOB Taproom also hosts an awesome trivia night on Wednesdays with tap takeovers and new release parties every month. There's always something going on, so come on by. Find them at the Canby Place on Southwest Berg Parkway and on Facebook and Instagram.
See you at the FOB.
And that's our show. Special thanks to our guest today, Dr. Max Cohen, and to all of our sponsors who really make it possible to do what we do. We encourage you to check them out and help support the local small businesses who support us. Hey, if you like what you just heard, please let us know. Write a review for us on Facebook, iTunes, or your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss our latest episodes. In our next episode, one of Canby's biggest annual events is just around the corner, the Independence Day celebration at Waite Park in downtown Canby. In our next episode, we sit down with the organizers to ask them about, well, the only thing that Frankie's kids really care about. Are the inflatables coming back this year? I want them to ask when they're going to get funnel cake, but whatever. If you have any tips, any ideas for guests we should invite on the program, or suggestions of how we can improve, please contact us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Canby Now. Or to learn how you can start supporting the show and gain access to exclusive content through Patreon, visit canbynowpod.com/plus.